The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. Now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but there are so many different versions of the Bible, who knows which one to trust? Yes, that's a common objection, and if you caught my debate last week, you'll recall that my opponent brought it up. I did address his concerns at that time, but since debates are limited in time, some elaboration seems in order. We will discuss Bible translations and other questions from the Bible. Later on in today's show, I'm also going to be welcoming back two special guests, Nancy J. Reed and Lisa D. Smith from Big Blend Radio. They have a passion for our national parks, and we are pleased to have them on again. First, some news commentary. Now, folks, let's just think about this logically. To any thinking observer, President Obama's own explanation offers an involuntary confession that he knowingly lied about his affordable health care law. Let me say that again. Obama knowingly lied about his affordable health care law. But rather than paying careful attention to his actual words, our country continues to argue about the motive of integrity of its president. At stake is a lot of damage that people were simply promised would never happen. Even NBC News reports that 50 to 75% of the 14 million Americans who purchase their insurance policies individually are likely to receive cancellations because their policies do not conform to new regulations from the Affordable Health Care Act. According to a recent Fox News poll, 50% of voters believe President Obama deliberately lied when he promised that people could keep the health care plans and doctors that they preferred. Still, Obama supporters, and he has many, such as House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer. They insist that no lie was told. Hoyer claims Obama's words were accurate at the time the statement was made. Hoyer said, "You understand that if you had a policy on the day that this bill was adopted, you got to keep it. Now, you didn't get to keep it if the insurance companies didn't want to offer it to you." Oh, I see, Steny. Well, thanks for the explanation. It's all so clear now. And so the debate rages on. Did Obama knowingly lie, or was he himself uninformed about the subtle nuances of his own health care law? Folks, look, we no longer need to speculate. The plain facts should now be obvious, even though people often miss the obvious. If you let a lying man talk long enough, the truth usually comes out. President Obama's own attempts at clarification reveal that he did indeed lie to the public. In a recent speech at the St. Regis Hotel in Washington, D.C., Obama tried to clean up his mess by explaining what he truly meant to say when putting forth blanket promises. Now, I'm going to read his words this time. I'm not going to do my Obama impersonation. I don't claim that I do a great one. It's probably a lame one, but the guy frustrates me so much, it's hard for me to read his words without hearing his voice. But these words are so important, I want you to pay attention to the words and not my lame impersonation. So I'm just going to read the words with no theatrics. Here's Obama trying to explain what he truly meant. "Now, if you have or had one of these plans before the Affordable Health Care Act came into law, and you really like that plan, what we said was you could keep it if it hasn't changed since the law was passed. So we wrote into the Affordable Care Act, you're grandfathered in on that plan. But if the insurance company changes it, then what we're saying is they've got to change it to a higher standard. They've got to make it better. They've got to improve the quality of the plan that they're selling. That's part of the promise we made, too. That's why we went out of our way to make sure that the law allowed for grandfathering. But if we had allowed these old plans to be downgraded or sold to new enrollees once the law had already passed, then we would have broken an even more important promise, making sure that Americans gain access to health care that doesn't leave them one illness away from financial ruin. When you listen to these politicians talk, don't you feel like Charlie Brown sitting in his room and his teacher's talking to him? Wah, 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 wah. It makes about as much sense as that. Look, this explanation is a far cry from Obama's original promise. It was repeated many, many, many times, including his speech on the 15th of June, 2010, where he said, in no uncertain terms, if you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor. Period. He put in the period. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor. Period. If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan. Period. No one will take it away, no matter what. No matter what? No matter what? Strange words, in as much as his recent explanation at the DC hotel says that there actually are a few what's and matters along the road. It matters when you got your insurance plan. It also matters if your insurance company made changes that conform to Obama's standards. Most people don't seem to be catching this. But the moment President Obama explains the fine print of his promises, he is admitting that he had an accurate understanding of the law all along, but simply chose not to speak the full truth. The only other possible explanation would be that he himself was such an incompetent leader that he didn't bother to read his own healthcare document. But if that is the case, then he is now attempting to cover up inexcusable ignorance by pretending he did know. We are left with two choices. He lied then, or he is lying now. Either way, the man is a liar, a bold-faced liar. His present explanation forces us to conclude that the original lie was in the original promise, even though we learn it through a roundabout explanation rather than a stated confession. Certainly, this isn't the first time our president has been caught telling a lie. We now know he had accurate information at his disposal when he claimed that the attack in Benghazi was a spontaneous reaction to a video rather than a coordinated act of terrorism. And there are others as well, but perhaps it's best not to focus on them. Ironically, Obama has benefited from too many lies and scandals taking place at one time. It makes the public grow numb to the plethora of accusations and increases, in the minds of some, the odds that Republicans might be making it all up. So one lie at a time. At a moment, the lie du jour is this. According to his own explanation, when President Obama said you could keep your health care plan and doctor, he was not speaking the truth, which means he was lying. Well, the news can be depressing. That's not why I talk about it. I talk because we need to be informed. We need to be discerning. We need to wake up. We need to try to take back our country before it's too late. But we don't need to let it get us down, because no matter what the immediate future, the day will come in the far future where we live in a just kingdom, the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And that, of course, is what we commemorate this holiday season.
Starlight, one small city of light.
is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric, Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Question. There are so many different versions of the Bible. How do we know which one to trust? Now, unless you're referring to the Apocrypha, a section in some Bibles included alongside the New and Old Testaments, we do not actually have different versions of the Bible, but rather different translations. But let me explain the Apocrypha before I talk about the translations. You'll usually find it in Catholic Bibles and some of it in the New English Bible. And people think, oh, that's a lot of Catholic doctrine. If you read the Apocrypha, well, that's the Catholic Bible, and it's different from the Protestant Bible. And in the Apocrypha, you'll read about the Virgin Mary, and you'll read about the Pope. That's not true. Actually, the Apocrypha is a lot of history that went on in Israel, some of it concurrent with the last few books of the Old Testament. Most of it during the 400 years in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Malachi was the last prophet. And after that, they had what the Jews called the 400-year period of silence. That was broken by John the Baptist, and we read about him early in the Gospels as the forerunner and announcer of Jesus. One of the reasons people ran out, even the priests and rabbis, to hear John the Baptist is this was pretty exciting stuff. Israel hadn't had a prophet in 400 years. Now, just because Israel hadn't had a prophet in 400 years didn't mean she didn't have an active history. She had a very active history, living under the Greeks, living under the Romans. The Hanukkah story and the miracle associated with that took place during that time. But because no prophets actually visited Israel, it was somewhat ambiguous to the rabbis whether those books, historical and accurate as they were actually inspired by the Spirit of God. So they put it in a separate section called the Apocrypha, meaning the hidden books. And it was just a question of, is this history or is this inspiration? I'm inclined to think of it as valid history. But again, it was because no prophet came during that time that they weren't sure what to do with it. So like I said, unless you're referring to the Apocrypha, we don't actually have different versions of the Bible. We have different translations. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is nothing unique to the Bible. All ancient works have numerous translations, alternative translations, from numerous translators because scholars and linguists enjoy making their own translations, and sometimes they enjoy using different synonyms for words. For example, a word describing the size of a rock might translate as large or big. And in any translation translated by a real team of scholars, the differences are minute. Now, yes, occasionally we get some people who don't really know Greek or Hebrew and attempt a translation anyway. We talked about that a couple of months ago, such as the Jehovah's Witnesses did with their New World Translation. But for the sake of future conversation, please note that when I refer to a translation, I mean a real translation. With that in mind, there is little difference between one Bible translation and another. And folks, the Greek and Hebrew manuscripts that the Bible was translated out of, they're in museums. You can look at them online. We can go back and read the Greek and Hebrew anytime we want if we have a question about the English translation. So even those volumes which include the Apocrypha, in those volumes, their Old and New Testaments are virtually the same as the Old and New Testament volumes that do not include the Apocrypha. Now, there is some minor difference to note between the King James Version and more modern versions, because when King James of England commissioned his translators in 1611, some key New Testament manuscripts had not yet been discovered. the Codex Sinaiticus, the Codex Alexandrius. Another key manuscript, the Codex Vaticanus, did exist at that time, but it was the property of Rome, and the Catholic Church certainly wasn't going to let the Church of England use it. Still, there are literally thousands upon thousands of New Testament manuscripts, and even when England printed the 1611 publication, they created a translation almost as accurate, but not quite as accurate as the modern ones. When I say not quite as accurate, I'm referring to a microscopic difference. Very few verses and very short verses. Nothing that makes any real difference to the overall gospel message. And I realize that different Christians prefer different versions. All too often, people are merely gravitating toward the version they were first exposed to. Since the translations are very similar, it's fairly harmless to do this. But still, the more we can include the latest manuscripts, the more accurate, obviously, we will be, because those latest manuscripts, they may have been late in being rediscovered, but they were much earlier when we date them. For myself, there are two translations that I prefer. I enjoy the New International Version because it captures the spirit of the Greek language, sometimes using some paraphrase to make its point. With certain Greek words or phrases, many ideas would come up in the mind of a Greek, and a one-word-for-one-word translation does not always capture this. On the other hand, for that same reason, I also enjoy the New American Standard Version because it is a more accurate word-for-word translation. For example, Romans chapter 8, verses 9 and 10 in the NIV says, "You, however, are controlled not by the sinful nature, but by the Spirit, if the Spirit of God lives in you. And if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he does not belong to Christ." That same verse says in the NASV, "However, you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. But if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he does not belong to him." The word flesh did mean sinful nature in ancient Greek, depending upon its context. NIV caught the spirit of the context and described it accurately. But still, the Greek text really does say flesh and does not say sinful nature. Also in Greek, the phrase being in the Spirit meant being controlled by the Spirit, but the actual word controlled was not actually there in the manuscripts. Therefore, each translation is providing its own special contribution. I want to know that the word controlled is not really there, but I also want to know that ancient Greeks would have thought about control when reading the phrase in the Spirit. I hope this helps. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Another subject that came up during the debate last week, and this is a subject that's raised by people all the time. If Jesus was really the Messiah of Israel, promised to Israel, then how come Jews don't accept him? Well, folks, yours truly is a Jew, and I've accepted him, but that answer is probably not going to satisfy most of you. There are a lot of Jewish Christians, but absolutely, throughout the last 2,000 years, the high majority of the Jews have not believed. And that's because the expectation of the Jewish Messiah and what the Jews thought the Messiah was supposed to do, Jesus did not do. But if you go back and you look at the prophets, they listed a bunch of things the Messiah was supposed to do. Jesus did a lot of them. He did not do all of them. He would have done all of them if the entire nation of Israel had accepted him. But let's take a look at perhaps the best prophecy about Jesus that we have. And you can find it in the Old Testament. You can find it in the Jewish scriptures, the versions translated by rabbis. 700 years before Jesus was born, Isaiah the prophet predicted that the Messiah would die for Israel's sins and then rise from the dead. Other prophecies about the Messiah, and Messiah means anointed one, one sent from God. When we say Christ, that's from the Greek version of the word Messiah, Messiah being closer to the Hebrew, Meshua. Other prophecies about the Messiah described a warrior who would deliver Israel from her enemies and then rule as king. The prophet Zechariah talked about that. This alternate understanding of the Messiah became the more popular one, and understandably so. The Jews were living under the Romans. They didn't want to hear about some dude that was going to die for their sins. They wanted to hear about some dude that was going to beat the snot out of the Romans, get rid of Pontius Pilate, and then rule Israel and live happily ever after. That is the type of Messiah that the Jews expected in Jesus' day, and that explains why he was rejected. It explains why Jews today have so much difficulty seeing Jesus as their Messiah. They say, if he's the Messiah, why isn't there peace on earth? If he is the Messiah, why didn't he become king? But there had been a time when the Messiah was also expected to suffer for our sins before ruling as king. Here are some highlights from the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. And of course, prophets will talk in the past tense, even when they're speaking of a future event. So he's talking about Jesus as if it already happened. But again, he's writing 700 years before. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment, he was taken away. Those are the words of Isaiah. But not only did Isaiah describe a Messiah who would suffer, he described a Messiah who would suffer and die. Isaiah goes on, he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people, he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. And then Isaiah says, after the death, the Messiah will live again, and the Messiah will rule. See, it's all here. The suffering, the death, the resurrection, and the ruling. See, he says, verse 10, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life. See, now he's coming back to life. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgression. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, Bob, if this prophecy is that obvious, then why don't more people become Christians, especially Jews? Well, there are two standard objections that people raise to this passage. They both break down, but let me tell you what they are. First, people say, oh, well, the original words of Isaiah did not contain these words. They were changed by the church to make it look like a fulfilled prophecy. Oh, really? My friend, the transmission of the Hebrew Old Testament text remained in the hands of the Jews, not the Christians. I have seen translations of this passage that the church never touched with a 10-foot pole. Even more compelling, the Dead Sea Scroll findings in 1947 produced another complete copy of the book of Isaiah. The date for this text is around 150 B.C. B.C. You also going to claim the Christians tampered with that? B.C.? Before Christ? Okay. Just doesn't work unless somebody wants to turn a DeLorean into a time machine and do that kind of thing. The other more standard objection, and this is the one that comes from most Jews, is that Isaiah did in fact write these words. They can't deny it. It's right there in their own Bible. And they'll say, well, Isaiah did write those words, but it's not being interpreted correctly. Yes, of course. The correct way to interpret the Bible is usually to make it say what you want it to say. That's what people usually mean. They will say, well, supposedly Isaiah is sharing an allegory. The suffering servant is not one individual, but rather the entire nation of Israel suffering as scapegoats at the hands of the Gentiles. Now, look, prophets did at times speak of Israel as if the entire country were a single person. However, there are several problems with that interpretation in this particular case. First of all, the chapter and verse divisions were not originally there. And Isaiah begins his discussion of the servant back in chapter 49, where the servant is clearly distinguished from Israel by being somebody who will minister to Israel. Isaiah 49, 5 and 6. And now the Lord says, he who formed me in the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him and gather Israel to himself, for I am honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has been my strength. He says, it is too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when the discourse continues, this remains the role of the servant as Israel's disobedience is described and the servant's faithfulness is described. I'm now reading from Isaiah 50:10. Who among you fears the Lord and obeys the words of his servant? He's talking to Israel. He says, who among you, Israel, fears the Lord and obeys the words of his servant? Let him who walks in the dark, who has no light, trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. This is the same topic and discourse that takes us all the way to the end of Isaiah 52. And at that time, the word servant is used, but it's not reintroduced. So they're obviously talking about the same servant who will save Israel. And that so much fits the context of Isaiah 53, verses 5 and 6, which I already read. But now let's look at it from this point of view. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Okay, so the theory here is, well, they're not talking about Jesus. The servant is Israel. Allow me to point out the obvious. That's what we do in the show. We make the obvious obvious. Isaiah was a Jew. Isaiah was not a Gentile. And Isaiah is saying he was wounded for our transgressions, including himself in the word our. As you see, an honest literary criticism taking the entire context into consideration dispels the idea of Israel being the suffering servant. But there's another case to be made, one which should carry far more weight with today's Jews, or at least Jews who want to be honest with their own traditions. The ancient rabbis, for the most part, also viewed Isaiah 53 as a reference to the Messiah. Now, please understand, I personally do not accept the ancient commentaries as being authoritative, but Orthodox Jews do. For example, if you ask them why they don't make animal sacrifices today in obedience to the law of Moses, they'll say, well, because the rabbis have told us that without the temple, we're not to make sacrifices. We can't make them. We have no temple. Well, I don't think that's a very good answer. After all, there was no temple from Moses through David. We're talking hundreds of years, and yet sacrifice still went on those many years, but never mind all that. It's okay, because it does tell us something about the credibility of the ancient rabbis in the minds of today's Jews. Well, then let's look at what the rabbis said about Isaiah 53. From the Targum, an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Bible in the first century, It says regarding this passage, "Behold, my servant, the Messiah, shall prosper. Then he will beseech concerning our sins and our iniquities for his sake will be given." The Zohar, an ancient book of Jewish mysticism, says the Messiah summons every pain and every chastisement of Israel. All of these come and rest upon him, as it is written, "Surely our sicknesses he carried." Also from the Zohar, "For you are wounded for the sins of the people, as it is written, he was wounded because of our transgressions." Faithful Shepherd says, "It is said of me, they made his grave with the wicked." From the Midrash, a commentary, ancient commentary of the Old Testament, "All the sufferings of the world are divided into three parts. One of them is borne by the Messiah." Also from the Midrash, the fifth interpretation refers to Messiah. "Come here" means to the throne, "and eat some bread," that is the bread of the throne, "and dip your morsel in vinegar." This refers to suffering, but he was wounded because of our transgressions. Another one from the Midrash, "Submissive, and yet he promises salvation," describing the Messiah, "for when they laughed at him while he sat in prison, he submitted for the sake of Israel to the judgment imposed on him, and there is therefore properly called submissive. Why is he spoken of as yet he promises salvation? Because after submitting to the judgment for their sakes, he said, 'All of you deserve extermination. Nevertheless, you will be saved, every one of you, by the mercy of the Holy Blessed One is he.'" Another one, also from the Midrash, "In the month of Nisan, in the year when the Messiah appears, the patriarchs will ask him whether he is displeased with Israel because of the affliction he endured upon them." It goes on and on and on. Now, in the 11th century, the very famous French scribe Rashi, Jewish scribe, shamelessly changed the interpretation of Isaiah 53 to mean Israel. That's where this idea of saying it's referring to Israel and not Jesus came from, or at least it became most popular from. Now, Rashi himself, you'll be interested to know, had once viewed the passage as a reference to the Messiah, but he had a habit of changing his view to answer Christians who debated him. And like I said, he shamelessly admitted that he changed his opinion for exactly that reason. And this wasn't the only verse where he did it. Observe his words on Psalm 21. Rashi says, "Our rabbis interpret it as a reference to King Messiah, but it is correct to interpret it as a reference to David himself, as a retort to the Christians who found it in support of their erroneous beliefs." Okay, let's wrap this up. Isaiah comes to us from the hands of the Jews, not the Christians. An honest reading of the text tells us that this is a reference to the Messiah. The commentaries of ancient Jewish rabbis also view it as a reference to the Messiah. The very rabbi who made the modern interpretation so popular admitted his reason for making such changes. None of this negates the fact that Jesus will still return someday to deliver Israel from her enemies. He will come as a warrior, and he will rule as a king. In short, Jesus will do the second time what the Jews expected him to do the first time, and he would have done it the first time had they accepted him. He just had this little problem with our sin that had to be dealt with first. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to The Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you. Last January, I had some very interesting guests on my program. It is my pleasure to have them on again with us today. Nancy J. Reed and Lisa D. Smith are owners and operators of Big Blend Magazines, which is related to Big Blend Radio. They are also a mother and daughter team that started working together over 20 years ago. It all began when Nancy, a successful wildlife artist, writer, and photographer, led tours from Los Angeles to Kenya, East Africa. And this ultimately led to her moving to Kenya, bringing a young 1.5-year-old Lisa along and working out in the field for writer and conservationist Joanne Addison of, or Adamson, I should say, of Born Free fame. Nancy and Lisa presently have a fascinating goal to visit each of the national parks by the end of the National Park Centennial on August 25th, 2017. During these visits, they have been hosting live on-location Big Blend radio broadcasts from the National Park Gateway communities, as well as producing videos for Big Blend TV, editorial pieces, and radio shows for each of Big Blend's 10 online radio and video magazines. Nancy Reed and Lisa Smith, welcome back to our program.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you both doing?
We're good. We're good. We're in Yuma, Arizona. We're in the oldest Best Western in the world.
You're in Yuma, Arizona. Boy, I always think of Yuma as the place where I'm going to stop to have lunch when I'm on my way to Tempe, and I usually get out of there as quick as I can. It looks like not much is going on out there. What's the big attraction of Yuma?
Well, actually, no. There's a lot happening. We actually started covering Yuma when we started our magazine up in Northeast San Diego back in 97, years ago. Yuma was one of the first places we kind of stepped out of the California zone and went, okay, let's go into Arizona. And there's a redevelopment happening here. And this is home to the Yuma Crossing National Heritage Area, which is the first national heritage area west of the Mississippi River. And this is where, when everybody wanted to go from the east to the west to go to the Gold Rush, you know, even Julian in San Diego, where you are, and you know, Encinitas even was part of the Gold Rush, and the oil, you had oil out there. People were coming across, and this is where the narrows happened for the Colorado River. It was the easiest place to cross over. So Yuma is that place, and they've been doing this redevelopment for the last 15 years. And right now, you know, after covering it for so long, it's really wonderful to see the downtown really prosper and be a real downtown district. And they have a wetlands area where you can go and hike along the water. They have beaver out here. I mean, you've got herons flying around, and you've got all the historical happening. So it's and events. They're like an eventful city. So it is definitely more than stopping off for lunch.
It shows
There's
how much.
There's a winery downtown, too. Can I just say that?
It just shows how little I know. I always thought of the Yuma as the place where you find the Foster Freeze, pack up on some extra sodas, and keep going.
Oh, no. People really need to get off the highway.
Now, I did live in Arizona for 2 years. I lived in Tempe and worked at Arizona State University. And although I don't care much for the desert, I have to say, it did kind of grow on me, especially the sunsets in the desert are absolutely magnificent.
And sunrises, too. And right now, the sunrises here in the morning are amazing. We have more clouds. We actually had 2 days of rain in Yuma, which never happens. This is like the sunniest place.
And I don't think they've discovered the color green out there yet, have they? I know they've heard of green.
You have to see the wetlands.
That's what I think. We're so used to, you know, going from San Diego to Tucson or to El Paso. This is really the place to stop, like you're saying, for lunch or getting gas. But really, the wetlands, it is green. I will send you a photo right now to show you how green it is.
All right. Send me that. I want to see the proof for this.
I will.
Now, tell me again, where is home for both of you? I know you're on the
There's
road
no
all the time.
We don't have a home anymore.
The last time we talked, Bob, and thank you for having us back on the show.
Sure.
You know, back in January when we last talked, and we were like, okay, we're going to go on the road 100%, and we did. And June, we decided to do this. June of 2013, we went 100% on the road. We packed up home. We gave everything away.
So where was home before you
Tucson.
Packed up? It was in Tucson?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So
but right now, there's no place where you're paying rent or there's no home that
no,
you
we
own?
We have a field box in North Hollywood because our friend Shannon takes care of that, my sister.
Wow. That must be fun. Now, do you travel in an RV?
No.
Just do you drive most of the way? Do you ever fly?
No. So we have a RAV4, and we have a suitcase each, so we drive everywhere. Because part of the thing about covering the national parks is covering the gateway communities so people understand the tourism of our country and understand the parks and how connected they are to the gateways. Like Yuma, it's a Yuma heritage area, and it's very connected. If the heritage area went away, part of the tourism would go away for this town. So that's really what we're about.
Now, do you stay in a lot of hotels, or I'm guessing you like to find places to camp quite a bit when you're doing this?
Hotels?
We do everything.
Hotels, we do vacation rentals,
whatever has to happen.
But we have to do a lot of production, so we do, because of the radio shows that we do, we have to do, you know, we have to have internet to do our shows.
Oh, that's right. So occasionally you have to plug into a tree out in the forest.
We have to be connected most of
I have to say, that sounds so exciting. It's always been a dream of mine. I often thought I would enjoy, if I had the money and I could pull it off, to just hop in a nice car, a nice new car where you don't have to do the maintenance or worry about it, and just keep driving and not even know where you're going to end up. That just sounds absolutely fascinating to me. The traveling that I have done, I've absolutely loved.
It's fun. It's a little bit more rigid, right, Nancy?
Well, we get to see what I would call the real America, and we get to talk to so many people. And I just have to say, I don't want to get political, but I'm just going to say that what we're seeing is not represented in our government at all.
Oh, well, I'm sure that's true. There's usually quite a disconnect between the government and the people.
Huge disconnect.
From both parties. Now, did this... since you did bring that up, did the government shutdown affect any of the national parks you visited? I heard that
all 401 of them got cut down. And in fact, we had a show on October 1st, and we were in the Sequoia region in Lindsay, California, actually. Super 8 Motel there. We were sitting there going, okay, we can do this or this, you know, on our trip. And we decided we better go back into Kings Canyon National Park because we were scared about getting footage and having being chopped from getting that footage. You know what I mean? That's how you feel. And we went back out there and we did get our footage. You can never get enough footage for a national park like that, you know. But we got our footage, came back, and of course, October 1st, boom, they did cut the national parks and the government shut down. And the thing, they did shut it down, and it did affect all 401 national parks got shut down, and the gateway communities, they suffered $30 million a day, the gateway communities. And so we did some radio shows on it. We had a radio show the day of the shutdown that wasn't supposed to be about that, but, you know, our national park representatives couldn't be there. They weren't even allowed to talk to us or email or do anything because they're employees of the national parks or the government. But we did have some representatives and tourism agencies and folks that were being, you know, affected by that come on. And then we did a couple other shows on that because it was devastating what happened.
Well, and it was so unnecessary because, as you know, the entire government did not shut down. Our president was selective about what shut down. And I think he wanted to shut down things that would make it hurt so that he could blame it on the Republicans. Of course, he was being just as stubborn as the Republicans were, and that side doesn't get covered as much. But it is a shame. I can think of about 100 things in the government that I'd like to see shut down before any of our national parks.
I agree with you, and I think both sides.
Way more than 100.
I will say both sides had a party on that. I mean, I think both sides really should have come to the table and grown up on that. I mean, when they attacked, John Jarvis, you know, the superintendent of the national parks, I thought that was really rude because the National Park Service, when they say shut down, they go into the shutdown mode.
Right.
And they didn't do anything wrong.
Actually, there is no shutdown mode. This is one thing Congress neglects. Nobody says how to shut down a park. It's not like you have chain link fencing around the parks.
Right. It just means that there's nobody on guard to be dealing with it.
Yeah, all it means is we're just going to abandon.
Yeah. And, of course, they did the same with our national monument.
And you know, really, we went to Yosemite National Park right after the shutdown. We were in Kings Canyon, Sequoia. Then we actually went up to Yosemite area, Tuolumne County, which we weren't planning on doing. We're supposed to be there in January, which we're going to do. We're going to go snowshoeing so people know about Yosemite in the snow season, but the fire happened up there. The rim fire happened, and so we were talking to the visitor folks up there, you know, Tuolumne County Visitor Bureau, and we're like, okay, well, we'll come up and let people know what's up there because there's so much going on, and Yosemite was still open, actually, during the fire, which, of course, mainstream media doesn't really show that Yosemite National Park actually was open and there were still things to do. So we went up there, and, of course, the shutdown had happened, And so the small communities, the devastation the small communities had, you know, financially was ridiculous.
Oh, of course. It affected their entire economy.
It, like, again, $30 million a day. Nationwide.
And
I mean,
I just have to say Congress really...
After a fire, too.
I have to say Congress didn't care, either party, because both parties...
Well, you know, but when you listen to the mainstream media, though, they make it sound like it was only Congress that didn't care and Obama was trying to work with them. Obama's definition of working with the Congress has been, if Congress would do things exactly my way, we could have bipartisanship. So I see that side of it too, and of course it was from the executive branch that they were making decisions about which things to shut down.
I just have to say, a politician is a politician. I don't care if it's a president or a senator or a congressman. A politician is a politician.
It's generally true. It's generally true. I'm having more trouble. I'm not actually a Republican myself, I should say. So I'm saying this a little bit objectively. I'm having far more problems with the president these days because he actually circumvents certain laws. But anyway, back to your tour. You told me last January that you wanted to, obviously it wasn't all going to be done in 1 year, but you wanted to visit as many parks as you could. How many have you visited since I last talked to you?
Well, actually, we did 10. We were supposed to be at 13. In fact, I talked to our friend Perry at the National Parks Conservation Association the other day. He said, well, how many parks are you at? I'm like, we're at 13. And it just dawned on me, no, we're not. Because the shutdown actually kind of shut down part of our plans and the itinerary. So we've done a few circles around, and it's very difficult. You would think you could just do this big master plan, which we had, of like, these are the parks you're going to do in these 5 years. Well, no, it doesn't work that way because life happens when you're making other plans.
Yeah.
John Lennon on that. But
how many different states were you in for those
10
parks?
We've been in New Mexico, Arizona, and California. And we're going to head back up into California again because Yosemite National Park is 150 years old in next year, in 2014. And that's because it was one of the very first California state parks. And the California State Park System will celebrate 150 years next year, which we're very happy for because they almost lost that last year and the year before, and we've been fighting that for a few years. And then suddenly you guys found that you had, the money was hidden somewhere. And, Santa Claus came out and said, you can have a park. But, you have such an incredible park system in California. But Yosemite was one of the first. And so we're going back through, and we're going to celebrate our anniversary, our magazine, radio, and even travel anniversary in Yosemite National Park in January. So we're excited.
Oh, that sounds great. And it's certainly one of the most beautiful parks I've ever seen, Yosemite.
It's incredible.
When you look at California is such a long state, right? There's 26 national parks, maybe 27 now because of they just added one.
And the California Redwood is the envy of the world. I mean, I've never seen anything more beautiful. When I'm driving up Highway 1 with the ocean to my left and the Redwood Forest to my right, it just doesn't get much better than that.
It's incredible. We've actually been on the beach there where there's actual...
I have to say this. Every park we've gone into, we are like, this is the best.
Yeah.
You love each one so much, and then you go to the next one, and you love that one even more.
And because they're so unique and they're so different.
Yeah, Bob, and Nancy says that, we think about places like Yosemite, the Sequoias. We've been to Sequoia National Park, Kings Canyon. I mean, just incredible, the deepest canyons in the world, But we've also been to some of the most historic parks that we forget about, these small parks in southeast Arizona, since we've talked to you. Fort Bowie National Historic Site, this is where, everything happened. The Butterfield stage route came through. Cochise, got captured there. I mean, Civil War happened there. I mean, this was one of these places that everything went down, the Apache Wars. Everything went down in this small park. And, we always tell people on our shows and everything we do is like, go to the visitor center first so you can get an idea of what you're seeing when you go out there. Well, you actually have to hike a mile and a half in.
Right.
And we did this in the middle of July in southeast Arizona, just saying, everyone.
I took
where it was, 112 in the shade?
Yeah, I would actually pick a different month.
We did this, but, actually it was really lush and green, and there was, monsoon storms, so it was pretty cool. But we got up there, and then you get to this fort, and, the history there, it's just, you can't go past this place where you're standing 2 feet away from where the Butterfield stage crew, that that whole route went.
This is
by
really...
and where Cochise got captured, within 2 feet of each other. And then you go up a little bit, and Geronimo's grandson, is a great-grandson, is buried there. You know, this is one of these places, one of the smallest parks, and I'm worried with what's happening with the government and Congress and national park budgets, that we're going to lose these small places that actually have a huge impact on our history.
This is the heart and soul of our country. This is how our country, it's our history. You know, when we lived in Europe, the Europeans kept saying, well, you're just a new country, you don't really have a history. And you know, I kept saying, yes, we do. And, you know, we're in danger of losing our history because of politicians. So, you know, our fight is to really create more national parks that safeguard our history and our natural wonders. And so for us, as we go to these smaller parks, that's why there's 401. Everybody knows Yellowstone, Yosemite, the Sequoias, but there's a lot of small ones that safeguard how this country was built. And that's important, just like nature is important. So for us, our battle is don't forget all the other small ones. Every time we go to something, we learn so much. And I'm afraid because our congressmen, senators, and maybe the president.
Maybe the president. It is the president also.
Well, they don't take the time to go see.
No, they don't. I'm talking to Nancy Reed and Lisa Smith. Nancy and Lisa, in the few minutes we have left, I'm fascinated when you talk about these little places with the historical things. Mm. Can you name a couple of other places that maybe people would never have even heard of, but they ought to go visit? Because they're always just thinking Yellowstone, Yosemite.
Right.
Name a couple of these other, what we might think of a little hole-in-the-wall place, but might be just a fascinating historical place.
Yeah, Fort Bowie National Historic Site, absolutely. I'd say the Gila Cliff Dwellings, where we've been in Silver City area of New Mexico, southwest corner of New Mexico. Definitely. You're talking about cliff dwellings, where you can actually go up into the cliff dwellings, but you don't get to see. And also, I would go right back into San Diego and hang out. Cabrillo National Monument.
Oh, Cabrillo is beautiful. I love it at Cabrillo.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, Nancy and Lisa, it's always great talking to you. Keep us informed. You're both delightful. I love the work you do, and keep it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. God bless you. We will see you next week, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.